Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, wishing you a very happy new year and best wishes for 2021. This hour, we're playing some holiday favorites from our archives, including a 2009 visit from They Might Be Giants. But first, some of you may have gotten some fancy gifts over the holidays, but how many of you received a carved ostrich egg? Hands, hands, don't see any. Too bad. Science Friday's Alexa Lim has this story.
When you want people to know that you've made it, there are certain symbols, objects that you buy to show that off. Could be a Rolex watch that cost as much as a down payment on a house, or maybe a garage full of cars, Ferraris, Rolls Royces. Well, back in the Iron and Bronze Age, if you wanted to flaunt your worth, you'd have a tomb full of carved ostrich eggs. Why ostrich eggs? And how did you get your hands on one anyway? That's what a team of scientists wanted to know. Their findings were published in the journal Antiquity. Joining me now is Tamar Hodos, an author on that study and a specialist in Mediterranean archaeology at the University of Bristol in Bristol, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here.
I guess my first question when I heard about these ostrich eggs is, what were they doing with them? They weren't walking around with them in their arms, kind of saying, look at me, right here I am.
The ones that we find in the Mediterranean are almost always in funerary contexts. So they're turning up in graves. Some of them are incredibly ornately decorated. They were fashioned into cups or jugs. So they would have had metal fittings, metal attachments to them. But they were also painted or carved with animal motifs, geometric motifs, floral motifs. Sometimes they show charioteers. So they're really ornately decorated. What we're not sure is exactly how they were being used. Were they being used as part of the funerary rituals? Or do they have some other additional, perhaps symbolic value? We really don't know. And it's likely to have differed from culture to culture. In the case of the Isis tomb in the British Museum, which is the one that kind of kick-started the whole project, there were five. So this is a really, really rich grave.
So it was still like Iron Age and Bronze Age bird bling, though.
Pretty much, yes, bird bling. I like that.
And, you know, decorating eggs isn't only an Iron Age fad. You know, there were Russian czars that collected Fabergé eggs. Easter is coming up. I mean, you said there's even an international egg art guild.
Well, the ostrich egg carving is a popular activity in the United States, in particular North America, and also in the Far East, in China. There has been an Egg Crafters Guild of Great Britain, although sadly it closed down a few years ago because of dwindling interest, but it was very, very active for a number of years and they had competitions that they ran. I conducted an interview with the president of the Egg Crafters Guild of Great Britain because I wanted to learn more about modern egg carving practices. And what she told me was that an egg needs to be left to dry naturally once it's been blown, once it's been emptied. It needs to be left to dry naturally for at least 6 months and ideally up to 2 years before it's ready to be carved. And this was something I was unaware of before, but in terms of my interest in the production of these ancient ostrich eggs as luxury items, that suddenly added a whole new dimension of the complexity of their production manufacture process, because it now adds a time element to it. You're not going to get a quick return from stealing your ostrich egg from the ostrich's nest. You now have to wait for it to dry naturally. You can't put it in the oven. You can't leave it out to dry in the sun. It needs to be left in stable conditions for an extended period of time. And that surely adds to its value status, because now we know it takes a long time to make as well.
Right. And I do want to come back to that. One of the basic questions that you had in your study is, these eggs were found in Italy, but there aren't ostriches in that part of the world. Where were they coming from?
That, in fact, was the underlying question that was driving this. Ostrich eggs, in particularly the Iron Age in the first millennium BCE, do turn up with, I guess I would say, surprising frequency in elite contexts, in elite burials. Not only in Italy, but also particularly in Spain, a number have been recorded, and elsewhere across the Mediterranean in regions where ostriches are not indigenous. And it does raise a question of where they're coming from. Ostriches in antiquity were indigenous to North Africa and the Levant.
Then they weren't penning these birds locally then? You had to get them where they were?
No, there's no evidence that ostriches in this era were living in Italy. The eggs themselves were coming from somewhere along the Eastern Mediterranean, possibly North Africa. We conducted isotopic analyses to look at the chemical elements that underpin the eggshell to determine past diet, past paleo environments. And what we were able to determine was that the eggs seemed to group into eggs laid in a cooler, wetter environment versus eggs laid in a hotter, drier environment. And the distinguishing line geographically turns out to be 30 degrees north latitude, which just cuts below the Nile Delta. So for the purposes of determining where these eggs in the Isis tomb came from, unfortunately, we cannot yet distinguish between the Nile Delta and, say, the Phoenician homeland, because they both are represented in that cooler, wetter environmental condition. But the most startling discovery we made in that regard was that just because you could source an ostrich egg locally doesn't mean you necessarily did. So in sites in the cooler, wetter zone, we found occasionally an example of an egg that had been laid in the hotter, drier zone, or where the mother was in a hotter, drier zone during ovulation, and vice versa. That adds a whole new level of questions about whether the raw eggs themselves, the unworked eggs, were those a source of trade in their own way? So this raises a question of whether there was also a sense of value in eggs that came from a different region.
You wanted to know if these were from domestic or wild ostriches, and your study found that these came from wild birds. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that they came from wild birds. But what that means is that somebody had to go and track the birds to find out or work out, establish where those nests were. And then they had to steal the eggs from the nest. An ostrich is an incredibly dangerous animal. They can kill you with a single kick, and their beaks are nasty. They're really sharp. So the ostrich was well known in antiquity to be an incredibly dangerous animal. Many cultures talk about them as wild beasts. And so somebody had to go and track, somebody had to go and collect, steal. And then there's this aspect of the eggs needed to be stored safely for an extended period of time before they would be ready for decoration.
You had to be a very experienced craftsman to carve into these eggshells. What did you find out about the techniques that were used to make these eggs?
We had bought a fresh ostrich egg, drained the egg, made a lot of cakes and quiches that kept us going for several days, and used a number of tools to try to replicate the smoothing and the polishing and the buffing, as well as the incision marks. We were able to reproduce some of the marks that we could see, particularly under the scanning electron microscope. Some of the motifs that we see, certain patterns that have been carved in some way, we are not entirely sure how they were made. We were absolutely unable to reproduce those. We have more work to be done in this regard.
Okay, so you've figured out these origins of these decorated eggs. So what is this telling you overall about the network of Bronze and Iron Age luxury items, how things were flowing?
There's a much more complex mechanism in luxury production. We tend to think about the luxury objects from the perspective of their find spots, which were with their users, their consumers, if you want. So we find them in these luxury graves. And as archaeologists, we often use this to look at the status of the individual and regard it from the perspective of where it was found. But rarely have we considered the whole mechanism to produce such an object, because you're not going to have an elite person going off and trying to steal eggs from a very dangerous animal.
Right.
So, and the craftsmen themselves are, they're the craftsmen, they're not the elites, but they're very highly skilled. And perhaps you needed someone who is a specialist in metalworking to put those metal fixtures onto the vessel. And that may well have been a different person who was the artisan who was carving the egg or painting the egg, because different skills are required. And so there's a whole class or variety of people involved in this wider luxury production industry, if you want to call it that. I mean, it implies it's on a much bigger scale. And it affects many more people than just the final users.
What other type of luxuries were there during this time?
Well, there's the most obvious that we would resonate with are metals, so gold and silver, but also ivory was a luxury item. Woods, there were luxury woods, ebony wood, cedar wood, cedars of Lebanon we recognize now. So there are a whole host of other organic luxuries. Giant clam shells, tridacna shells that originate from the Red Sea are found in the Mediterranean, particularly during the first millennium. They were also carved and painted. We believe they were used as cosmetic containers. But again, that's another piece of evidence of the far-reaching exchange trade mechanisms and that highly skilled artisanship of ancient craftsmen, and then this connection to luxury desire by elites.
If you were going to decorate your tomb, which one would you choose?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Oh, I don't know if I could choose.
You'd have them all.
I'd have them all. Absolutely. I'd have them all.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Producer Alexa Lim, speaking with Tamar Hodos, a specialist in Mediterranean archaeology at the University of Bristol in England. We need to take a break, and when we come back, another nugget from our archives exploring the sounds of the animal kingdom. Stay with us.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea, it's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like this.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're dipping into the Sci-Fry archives this hour for the new year. And now a piece that dates back to March of 2020. It turns out that was only 9 months ago, right? Doesn't it feel longer? And unbeknownst to us, it was a good time to unveil a resource to help people travel the natural world via computer. We know you can't pass up a good charismatic creature story, but how good are you at identifying the sound of your favorite animal? To test your knowledge, we've put together an interactive animal sound quiz that you can play. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/animal quiz. Sci-Fry Digital producer Daniel Peterschmidt and quiz creator is here to talk about our Google Earth animal sound quiz. He's going to test my recall skills. Sorry. He's joining us by Skype. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Ira. How's it going?
Okay. Let's talk about why animal sounds. How did you come up with this idea?
Yeah, so the idea came from our events producer, Diana Montano, who made a version of this for our last Sci-Fry Trivia Night, which you co-hosted. You were there.
Yeah, it was great.
So animals have an incredible diversity in how they look, but they also have an incredible diversity in how they sound, and how they look might not match up with their calls. So we made a quiz to see if you can match that animal sound with an animal.
And you built this as part of Google Earth's Voyager platform. Can you describe how you built it and what's the quiz like?
Yeah, so Voyager is this editorial platform in Google Earth, and they work with different publishers to make these cool, sciencey, interactive stories using their 3D imagery and Street View. And we have another cool project we did with them where we made a tour of NASA's launch pads at Cape Canaveral. But with this animal sounds quiz, we picked animals from all over the world, so you'll be hopping around the globe a lot in this. And it takes you, when you guess it correctly or incorrectly, it takes you to their habitat. We tried to find these animals in Street View, so I was just like Googling bald eagle in Street View, and I only found a few. The bald eagle that we ended up going with was from a zoo in Germany. I found a hyena, but it was kind of off in the distance, but it is there. Stuff like the katydid, which is this small green insect, was basically, it's kind of hard to find those since they're so small, but okay, we did our best.
I am ready for the short version. Let's play a little short version of the quiz right now. Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, so this first animal sounds like a synthesizer or a Game Boy. It does not sound organic at all. I know I'm joining by Skype, but I promise this isn't those like bloopy sounds it plays when you're connecting to someone. So I'll play it and give you a multiple choice guess after it plays.
All right, let's play clip number one. Okay, Daniel.
Okay. Yeah. So is that A, a giant golden crowned flying fox bat? B, is it a Baffin Bay narwhal? C, Weddell seal? Or is it a clip from Pink Floyd's album Animals?
You know, you could not have picked a better sound for my first sound because I know exactly what that is. I thought you took it off of my cassette tape that I took when I was in Antarctica in 1979. I watched people investigating Weddell seals under the ice with a microphone. They stuck it down in the water, and that is the exact sound the Weddell seal makes. So,
yeah, you got
C, it. C, ding, that's number so cool.
three. Yeah, C is correct. All right. I am not going to give you multiple choice for this next one.
Okay.
But this next one is a bird, and can you guess which bird makes this call?
Wow, I'm thinking of my bird feeder in my backyard, and I'm thinking of three or four birds, and one of my favorites is a nuthatch, so I know it's not, but I'm going to guess it anyhow.
Yeah, that good guess. You probably wouldn't find this bird in your backyard. This is actually the sound a bald eagle makes.
No kidding.
Yeah, so that sound you hear in movies and stuff, that's usually like a red-tailed hawk or something like that, you know, the fearsome caw or screech. I was looking for these sounds on YouTube, and I was looking in the comments, and someone said in the comments, like, and this is why you don't hear these sounds, why you don't hear the bald eagle sound in movies.
I'm calling Stephen Colbert right up and telling him to get rid of that.
Yeah, I know.
All right, you have another sound for us.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Let's go for it. We don't. No, that's it.
We don't.
Two sounds.
All right, well, I can like imitate the sound for you if you want.
Yeah, I would. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, so sounds something like this. And just going back and forth like that.
One more time. It's an animal in the wild, huh?
Yes.
You stepped on your cat's tail. I don't know what that...
You're onto it.
Oh, come on.
So, yeah, no, it's called a Canadian lynx.
Ooh.
And they sound not dissimilar to like humans if they try to make that sound, but they make that sound so that, like, you know, they have this big teeth and big claws.
Right.
And instead of getting in fights, they just yell at each other, kind of like humans.
So how many sounds do you have up there on the website?
Yeah, so we have 9 of them. And we have birds, mammals, fish, everything. We got it all.
And it's up on our website. What's the address? ScienceFriday.com/...
Animal quiz.
Animal quiz. You must have had a lot of fun doing this, Daniel.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun listening to the first drafts and hearing the sounds that Google picked, and it was great.
Okay, well, we'll have you on for the next round. Thank you. Thanks a lot for this. It's Daniel Peterschmidt, a Sci-Fi digital producer and creator of our Google Earth Animal Sound Quiz. Thank you, Daniel.
Great talking to you, Ira.
And you can play it, as he says, up on our website at sciencefriday.com/animalquiz. Now, to really turn on the Wayback Machine, dialing it back to September of 2009. Because when we thought about what message we really wanted to start the new year with, we decided you couldn't do better than a reminder that science is real.
Science is real. From the Big Bang to DNA. Science is real. From evolution to the Milky Way. I like those stories about angels, unicorns.
is real.
We sure hope so, because you're listening to Science Friday, and that was Science is Real by the band They Might Be Giants. And joining me now in the studio here in New York is John Linnell and John Flansburgh, also on the drums, Marty Beller in the background. We'll be playing a lot of music. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be here.
Why would you do songs about science? I mean, I thought only geeks like me like science.
Because we're like you.
Are you? Did you do a lot of...
This is really a big thrill for us because, you know, we've been listening to the show for a long time. It's like suddenly like we're inside the TV set or the radio. You know, it's kind of trippy.
Were you science-y geeks when you were in school?
Not exactly, no. I mean, it's actually a little bit of a stretch in a way for us to declare ourselves to be authorities on science.
This is the Peter Principle in
exactly,
full bloom.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're stepping into a little quagmire by naming a song Science is Real. There are a lot of people who don't believe science.
Well, you see, that's not controversial for us.
Not for you.
No.
But have you heard any reaction from people who say,
Well, you know, I don't think judging by YouTube flame comments, you can really get an accurate gauge of what in general, it seems like people are actually quite positive about the whole prospect.
Right. But people we meet face to face are like you, pretty much.
Well, that's so good. Name the songs on the album.
Meet the Elements, Photosynthesis, My Brother the Ape, I Am a Paleontologist, Roy G. Biv, which is about the color spectrum, light spectrum. I don't know, John, what other
cells?
Titles? Cells.
Why Does the Sun Shine?
Why Does the Sun Shine? Speed and Velocity.
And now these all sound like kids' songs. Are these aimed at kids?
It's sort of a mixed bag. There are some songs that are very simple that are good for little kids.
Right.
And then there are songs that are more fact-packed that probably would, you know, be a little bit too complicated for a toddler, but you know, if you're, the song we're gonna play, Meet the Elements. Like, if this existed in my freshman year of high school, it would have been an incredible godsend for my grades.
Well, you know, when I hear a song Meet the Elements, who am I thinking of? Not of you guys, way before you guys were born, Tom Lehrer. Right? You remember the Elements song? Do you remember Tom Lehrer?
No, actually.
I know the song Pollution by Tom Lehrer.
No, he did a whole song of the Elements that's much different than
probably
yours.
More satirical than ours.
Yeah, well,
I can't believe that guy like invented a time machine and went backwards and stole our ideas. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that song.
He just rattles through the table of elements, periodic table of elements.
Well, that's what we're doing.
What made you
imagine our disappointment that we find out? No, but you know what?
He was a folk singer. Isn't
No.
What made you write this song? Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this song.
We were working on our science album, and I guess the thing is we wanted to cover all of the different areas of science. So we're thinking chemistry, biology, physics, earth science, applied science. You know, we're just trying stepping into each one. And I find the periodic table of the elements to be kind of a great organizational, an amazing inspiration, actually. That it's a grid. You can just look at it and say, it's all laid out simply. It's like a lot simpler than a lot of other science charts that you have to study. So this one seemed like it was something you could stare at and write a song based on.
I'm Ira Flatto. You're listening to Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is an interview from our archives, recorded in September of 2009. And we're going to hear a cut from the album. Here they are. They might be giants playing.
Meet the elements.
Meet the elements. Let's meet them now.
Iron is a metal. You see it every day. Oxygen eventually will make it rust away. Carbon in its ordinary form is coal. Crush it together and diamonds are born. Come on, come on and meet the elements. May I introduce you to a friend, the elements. Like a box of paints that are mixed to make every shade. They either combine to make a chemical compound or stand alone as they are. Neon's a gas that lights up a sign at a pizza place. The coins that you pay with are copper, nickel, and zinc. Silicon and oxygen make concrete, bricks, and glass. Now add some gold and silver for some pizza place class. Come on, come on and meet the elements. I think you should check out the ones that call the elements. Like a box of paints that are mixed to make every shade. They either combine to make a chemical compound or stand alone as they are. Up with other elements, forming compounds when they combine, or make up a simple element formed out of atoms of the one kind. Balloons are full of helium, and so is every star. Stars are mostly hydrogen, which may someday drive your car. Hey, who let in all these elephants? Don't you know that elephants are made of elements? Elephants are mostly made of four elements, and every living thing is mostly made of four elements. Plants, bugs, trees, worms, bacteria, and men are mostly carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. Come on and meet the elements. You and I are complicated, but we're made of elements. Like a box of paints that are mixed to make every shade. They either combine to make a chemical compound or stand alone as they are. Team up with other elements, forming compounds when they combine. Or make up a simple element formed out of atoms of the one kind. Come on, come on, meet the elements. Check out the ones that call the elements. Like a box of paints that are mixed to make every shade. They either combine to make a chemical compound or stand alone as they are.
Wow, that was great.
Thank you.
That was nothing like... that was much better. That's a great song.
We haven't heard the Tom Lehrer song, so I can't possibly comment.
This was just terrific. How long did it take you to write that song? Months, years, decades, lifetime?
That's a secret. People are going to, if we do a work, if we do like some kind of theme for somebody, they're going to want to pay us less if we... Wow. Reveal how quickly you can write a song.
Well, just to remind our audience, we're talking with the band. They Might Be Giants, and their new album is Here Comes Science. Is it out now?
Can it is it out. On iTunes as of yesterday. It is
really?
Out everywhere. You can buy it at Target.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And you can download
right
it?
Right next to Miley Cyrus.
We're going to take a break on this New Year's Day and come back with more from my 2009 conversation with John Flansburg and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants, who spoke with us the day after the release of their album, Here Comes Science. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, taking a New Year's trip into the Sci-Fry Archive Vault to revisit an interview with John Flansburg and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants, recorded way back in September of 2009. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Sitting in. I wish I used to play the accordion.
Man, start jamming. Feel free.
With the band, they might be Giants, and the new album is out yesterday. Here Comes Science with John Flansburgh and John Linnell. Also, they're playing the music for us, and not to be outdone is Marty Beller's here with the drums.
The king of the drums.
The king of the percussion.
Marty is actually playing an electronic drum kit, which is brand new. It's his brand new thing.
You know, that explains why I tried to go over and hit, you know, use my fingers.
Oh, yeah.
And
no
nothing
sounds.
Happened.
Yeah.
It's a electronic. Huh?
You need the magic of electricity.
What an age we live in. And I'm surrounded by, I guess I'd call them music geeks, music science geeks, because they're writing albums about science. And what's the next song we'd love to hear from you?
Well, this has a little story behind it. We used to cover a science song. In fact, we still do, called Why Does the Sun Shine, which is from a bunch of science, it's a collection of science songs that came out when we were kids with Tom Glaser. And I don't know if you're familiar with this record, but the sun was called, Why Does the Sun Shine? And in parentheses, the sun is a mass of incandescent gas. And what we found out was that subsequently they figured out that the sun is not actually made of gas after this song had become popular among kids. And
sure it is.
Well, apparently it's not.
Well, I better relearn something else.
We're here to tell you that there are four states of matter, and the sun is actually a super excited gas, which is called plasma, where the electrons have been stripped off precisely. And so we were forced to write this answer song to our own very popular Why Does the Sun Shine?
Which is something we only do reluctantly. This whole fact-checking thing is very difficult for a rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, musicians don't normally care about whether there's plasma or
gas. We care about beauty and poetry.
Yeah.
Those are our main concerns.
All our lies are in our past. We're forgetting about
but
the
it
lies.
But it speaks very highly of you that you want to change the song to get it right.
Yeah, it was just sort of fun, too. I mean, basically, an engineer we were working with, we were actually talking about the conundrum of the whole thing because we had already re-recorded this famous song from our repertoire for this album. And we were just like, well, what are we going to do? It's outdated. It's, you know, mm-hmm. science has evolved. The consensus has moved on from the idea of the song. And this engineer, John Altshuler, actually said, why don't you just write a song called The Sun is a Miasma of Incandescent Plasma? And that's what we did.
And so, is that the name of the song?
Yeah,
that is the song.
All right, here it is.
Plasma.
Here they is. They might be giants from their album Here Comes Science. Great. That's great.
Ira, I have to say we've been on a million radio shows, and the reverence with which you show the length and ending of a song is truly a recessive trait in in DJs, hosts, radio people.
You want to know why that is?
It was beautiful. Like when you actually at the top of the thing where you played the entire song, Science is Real, like, you know, typically, you know, people just hit the fader 30 seconds right before it ends. It's like, oh, we don't have that kind of time.
I will tell you why that is.
That's why I love, I love public radio.
I come from a public radio FM classical music background.
When
I was in my learning days at WBFO in Buffalo, if I ever faded down one note of a classical music, I once had an argument that I was the news director and I wanted to fade down the music. So I could get a bulletin in there.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I heard you can't run a bulletin, you can't interrupt an FM radio.
Classical music. So you were like the king of dead air.
You just let the song go all the way. You wrote the whole song.
Well, no.
Why don't we hear the whole song?
You actually let a little silence in after that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Our guy in Boston, I guess, was Robert J. Lertzema. It would seem like he'd fallen asleep. You know, like it was this quiet.
I remember him.
It was like, that was.
It suggests a whole different kind of lifestyle. Fantastic.
Yeah. I have a suggestion for a song for you. You know, you talked about the mistake with the makeup of the sun. How about something about Pluto not being a planet?
We do have a song. We haven't learned how to perform it in this group, but with this arrangement.
We
do have a song called "How Many Planets," where we dodge the question of how many planets there are by simply enumerating everything, planet or not. In the course of the song,
let the people decide.
Let the people decide. Yeah.
What's your opinion on that, Ira?
I don't think it really matters. You know, I don't think that it matters that Pluto is.
Well,
then we're in agreement.
That's more or less what we're expressing in the song. Yeah, who cares?
If I were pressed, I'd have to say yes. There are eight planets, but it doesn't really matter that Pluto has been demoted because it's just a name for something.
Yeah, you know, I think everybody kind of feels for Pluto a little bit, though.
Yeah.
I think Woody Harrelson should be a planet, too. So that makes nine.
Well, there are people who are, you know, are space cadets, but...
What's that email address again, Ira?
Don't send it to me. Send it to John Linnell. He will take
That's right. I'll take questions.
Go ahead.
I'm willing to debate.
You never ask anybody this question, but I'll, you know, you never ask anybody, who's your favorite kid, right? And you ask musicians, what's your favorite song that you have?
It's funny. Yeah, we do get that. And we are, it's like insulting, you know. How could you ask that? Oh, I'm appalled.
I remember there was a radio station that used to advertise itself as one of two of America's great radio stations, so you never had to ask what the second one is. So,
well, if we said it's a Tom Lehrer song, would we suddenly reveal something?
Let's see if we can get another song in.
It's a laughter epidemic.
What should we do? Come on.
Let's do My Brother the Ape.
Brother, here they are. They might be giants.
About evolution, that controversial fact.
Well, I got the information that she sent to everyone, and I told you family picnics aren't exactly my idea of fun. You replied that everyone with me said they were going to come, and that's how you talked me into going to the reunion. When you said everyone, you really meant my brother the ape, my brother the ape. I received the photos you sent, and I don't regret that I went. Are the sight of everybody stiffly posing under one tent? But I don't feel I belong, and I keep wanting to escape. And I fail to see the likeness between me and my brother the my cousin the shrimp, or my distant kin the lichen, or the snowy eagle, or the moss. And I find it hard to recognize some relatives of ours, like the roach, the sycamore, iguanas, and sea stars. My brother the ape, my brother the ape.
terrific. They Might Be Giants, the new album. Here Comes Science. John Flansburgh and John Linnell here in the studio with us, rocking away, and also on the drums, Marty Beller back there. Not saying very much, a silent part. Are there any other folks you play with? Any people in your band?
Yes.
We actually are. We're just about to go out on tour. We're doing some family shows as well as a Flood show where we're playing our 1990 breakthrough album Flood in sequence. That's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime deal for us. And then we're doing this whole new show for adults. But joining us on stage is this fellow named Ralph Carney, who's famous among musicians for being the guy who plays on all the Tom Waits, sort of the classic Tom Waits middle period circus music albums. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He plays a lot of different kinds of horns. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be joining us, and it'll be very interesting working with somebody who's got such a clear voice as a musician. It's very it'll
unlike,
it's a real
unlike
departure.
The rest of us.
Yeah. We're just hacking along. Yeah.
Well, we also have Dan Miller plays guitar and Danny Weinkoff plays bass. So it'll be a six piece, basically. Yeah,
and
double.
And where are you going to be? Where can people see you?
Everywhere. We're Los Angeles.
You got a schedule at all? You can tell us your next. Guess your next.
I would say go to our website.
They Might Be Giants. Or go to Facebook. Facebook has got all that information. Yeah. We got all these, and also there are all these videos. If people want to see videos of these songs, the entire album Here Comes Science has been made into a DVD, and there are all these animated videos accompanying the music, and some of them are really quite remarkable.
So we might see you on an MTV video sometime?
I don't think MTV is playing videos anymore. if they were, they certainly no. I mean, it's shocking.
Yeah.
To everyone.
Right. I know it's
especially musicians.
I have two daughters. I know it's on that.
It's more of a lifestyle. Music is more of a lifestyle expression these days.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they'd really warm up to science that much.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
We're on the radio, guys.
I'm Ira Flatow. Have you never been on the radio before?
But I'm not on Science Friday. That's a big deal.
Wow, I'm very flattered. Yeah. You know, because we all wish we could do something else. I wish I could play a musical instrument.
I was just hoping that we'd be on Science Friday.
Well, one of us got our wish.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And is there a topic you'd like to take on that you haven't done yet, a subject matter?
We're thinking, we're tossing around ideas for the next Disney-produced Giants record, instructional music for young people. We're thinking maybe There Goes Your Civil Rights could be the next one. That was one idea I think Flansburgh had.
Yeah.
Here come the
syndicalists. We could do like a history, like sort of a people's history of America.
People's history of America, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Have you got a quick song you could sing? We could take
Sure. What should we do?
Do you want to hear a non-science song?
Sure, whatever. We only got a couple of minutes left.
I say that, but I don't have anything in my mind.
Well, play us out to the end of the show. And
why don't we do a song that's factually incorrect?
Go ahead.
Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople, now church alight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople.
No, you can't go back to Constantinople.
Been a long time gone, Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Istanbul.
Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, what a Constantinople, got the worst. That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
Thank you.
them to talk until the music stops.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that song. I know that song. It's an oldie moldie.
Yeah, it's super moldy.
And that's not on this album, though.
No,
it is not.
But it's still a great song. So if people go to watch you in concert, do you play other stuff besides
this? Oh, yeah. No, I mean, these albums are only 40 minutes. Even when we're doing the Flood, like, sort of, you know, tribute to ourselves show, it's only 40 minutes of the show, and the show's like an hour. The family shows are like an hour 15. The adult shows are like an hour 45, sometimes 2 hours when we're feeling heroic and when we're in our Bruce Springsteen mode. Things start expanding in the mannerist period of the
Yeah. Band. I think we play more songs per show than Bruce, but probably only about half as long.
All right. I'm going to have to drop in.
Please come on. Yeah, bring your accordion.
Bring my accordion. Try not to talk about that.
Plenty of room. Actually, use one of ours.
I just have to bring my chopsticks. Is the only thing I can hit. I'm a frustrated drummer too, so thank you, Marty. I won't even try to do that. Well, we've run out of time, but you guys were terrific for coming.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You took up our whole studio with your musical instruments. You're welcome anytime you want to come back.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
You're welcome. John Flansburg, John Linnell, also on the drums, Marty Beller. They Might Be Giants. The new album is Here Comes Science, and Here Goes Science, because that's the end of our program. Thank you all
for
taking time to be with us today. If you missed any part of this program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Oh, one more thing. On our Science Friday Vox Pop app, we miss you. We want to hear what science stories you're thinking about these days. So please send us a message and say hello. That's on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. Wishing you and yours the very happiest and healthiest of New Year's, I'm Ira Flatow.